unless you really do have deep musical knowledge, you may not even realize when appropriation is happening.
That's very well.
You know, step back and consider whether your musical knowledge or lack thereof might be obscuring your ability to even recognize cultural appropriation. Welcome to the I'm All Over the Place podcast with Dara Starr Tucker. My name is Dara Starr Tucker, and I am glad to be joined today by my willing and lovely co-host. Well, that doesn't really sound like a great descriptor for you.
The gopher. The gopher of all time.
You're more than that.
Greg Bryant.
You're more than that. We got to find like a good, I don't know, a good podcast name for you.
I just like being here. I like putting the spotlight on you. I am proud of you. Very proud of you. And I'm proud of you all listening to us right now. First of all, before we go into why I'm proud, if you are new, welcome. Dara, where can they find you on all of your platforms?
They can find me on Instagram at Dara Tucker B. They can find me on TikTok at Dara Starr Tucker. I'm on YouTube. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Twitter. I'm all over the place.
Indeed.
You can probably find me on the moon if you look.
Wow. Wow. That's a powerful reflection. That must be why in 3 days, we've already got well over 1,000 downloads for episode 7.
1,000 of y'all. 1,000 of y'all. I'm also on Patreon. I'm on Patreon.
Oh, yeah. Now, say
Dara Starr Tucker. I always forget to talk about the Patreon.
Folks, and those of you who may want to do something additionally, it's been in the comments on several of our Instagrams and TikToks. If you want to show, you know, tangible support, Patreon is one way. Tell them about that.
Yeah, I think we're up to probably 30 patrons at this point, which is really cool. These are the folks that decide to support us on a monthly basis. So they get access to exclusive content. Sometimes I'll release videos to them before I release them to the general public, or I'll say, hey, should I do this type of video or that type of video? There was one point where someone requested that I do a specific video. He just wanted me to talk about how I got into this kind of work, social justice work, social commentary versus being a singer. So I did an entire 15-minute video just for one of my patrons. And so this is the kind of access that you will have if you sign up for the Patreon. So that's patreon.com and then my name / Dara Starr Tucker. And of course, you can find all of this stuff in the links in my social media. But come on over and see me on Patreon. There's some cool stuff going on over there. Polls. there's lots of interesting stuff that the general public does not have access to. And I answer all of my patrons. So if you ever want to just have a convo with me about whatever it is, that's a good place to do it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And DaraStarTucker.com for inquiries. If you want to know more about the podcast, learn how to support, you know, have certain topics of interest that's available to all that information is on the contact page. Today, cultural appropriation. You've probably seen by now, if you are a Dara Starr Tucker fan, the Instagram and TikTok posts of a very, I'd say, almost viral video at this point shared by...
I don't know if it's quite viral.
My word for it. Mini viral.
it's done all right. It's, you know, for me on Instagram, getting 100,000 views is a lot.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know if that constitutes a viral video.
I'm being overblown, probably. I was excited to see so many people share and weigh in. I think what you did in 6 minutes, really closer to 5, was amazingly thorough, accurate, and tended to speak to the zeitgeist of a lot of people out there who have feelings about what is cultural appreciation, what is exploitation. And I think you've chosen today a great extended meditation and discussion about this, because there's several things that you just don't get to talk about in 6 minutes or in 5 minutes. And for the people who haven't seen it yet, let's pull it up and take a quick listen. This is under the title, of course, this is in your breakdown series. This is called When Does Appreciation Become Appropriation? Let's take a look.
For many people, this is the king. Well, you ain't never gonna rather hang your hand on a friend of mine. But for a large swath of the black population in the U.S., the only thing he's the king of is cultural appropriation. You ain't nothing but a Now, some would argue that because Elvis helped to popularize Black American music all around the world, he should be celebrated as something of a de facto cultural ambassador for Black music. In their eyes, what he did was appreciation, not appropriation. And even if it was appropriation, what's the big deal anyway? You can't own culture. But is it really that simple? Should culture be safeguarded and protected? When does appreciation become appropriation? I'm Dara Starr Tucker, and this is The Breakdown. Elvis's success opened the floodgates for a slew of artists who have gained popularity over the years performing music that was born out of the struggle, triumph, and creativity of Black Americans. Though Elvis Presley is the most famous person to be accused of cultural appropriation, he certainly isn't the only one.
Mommy, I'm coming.
He's not even the first. But what exactly is cultural appropriation, and why is it always seen as a negative thing? The Encyclopedia Britannica defines cultural appropriation this way: a member of a majority group profiting financially or socially from the culture of a minority group. Well, newsflash, that happens a whole lot. Sports teams being named after Native Americans, the rampant use of AAVE by any and everyone in online spaces.
Oh, Whoop the Whoop gonna be there like your favorite rapper, the big ass person.
And endless musical groups who have taken the affects and stylings of Black musicians without any real attempt to pay homage to where the music and style actually came from. Started from the bottom, but I still make boss. But why is this referred to as appropriation and not as appreciation? Well, let's use language as an example. I learned the German language because I appreciated it. I acknowledge where it came from, who developed it, who spoke it first, and I look to native speakers to guide me in my usage of their language. I don't mind acknowledging that I'm a visitor to their culture, and I always will be. As an informal American dialect, African-American vernacular English is barely recognized as anything other than Gen Z slang by the culture at large.
We now return to the thrilling conclusion of Gen Z Hospital.
Is Bestie gonna be okay? I'm so pressed right now, bro.
Don't be pressed. The doctor will be in shortly, bro. Dead ass.
It's co-opted, misused, and adopted by those seeking to gain social clout.
I did give you some lays, because I wanted a little bit of cringe with my feeling, you know what I'm saying? Okay, period.
And when that happens, its origins are often discounted as if it just rose up from the earth. The idea that it actually belongs to anyone is seen as almost laughable. African Americans who speak this way are often looked down upon, while white kids use it to increase their social media following and get record deals. When appreciation begins to take on an element of exploitation, it becomes appropriation. In other words, the person from that majority group now stands to gain something, either financially or through increased social cachet, by taking on mannerisms, language, symbols, customs, or styles that they picked up from a minority group. Does this require avarice or malice on the part of the person doing the appropriating? Well, not necessarily. Can the effect still be harmful to that minority group? Absolutely. Minority groups are often vilified or marginalized for the same behaviors that are praised once someone from the majority culture engages in them. Full lips and hips, dreadlocks, streetwear, not to mention hip-hop, R&B, rock and roll, the blues. These were all seen as dangerous, low-class, or objectionable until white kids started to latch onto them. History is filled with Black artists who have been shortchanged or overlooked altogether when white performers and executives figured out how to monetize Black art. So it's no wonder that minority groups would feel possessive about their culture. Many people feel that safeguarding it and protecting it from exploitation is necessary to ensure that members of that minority group are in the best position to reap the financial benefits of the popularity of that art. But it's not just about financial gain. It's also about safeguarding culture and traditions that can be very easily absorbed by the mainstream with no acknowledgement of where the art came from. And those two concepts are really at the heart of this discussion: acknowledgement and compensation. Black music's popularity in the mainstream has come at the expense of any substantive acknowledgement of the contribution that Black artists have made to the advancement of popular music. From syncopated rhythms to blue notes to dominant chord voicings, the very foundation of popular American music rests on the shoulders of Black innovators. But all too often, they're seen as an afterthought, underpaid, underappreciated, and unacknowledged. Well, look at this shiny piece of gold I found on the ground while walking through Negro Town. Guess it belongs to me now. Now, obviously, style isn't something that can be copyrighted. You can't trademark swagger. No one's going to pay you royalties for drip. When mainstream culture starts to catch on to AAVE, musical styles, or clothing trends, historically, Black people have responded with startling consistency. We move on. We create something new, and that new thing often ends up being vilified until young white kids start doing it, and designers and record execs figure out a way to make it profitable, and the cycle continues. It's very telling that the idea of culture is so loosely regarded, particularly among younger people who may not even understand what it is. Think about it. If the only real representation of true culture that you see around you comes from the black and brown kids at your school, or the ones you see online or in the movies, you'd want to be a part of that, especially if the closest thing that you've had to culture is Walmart, mega churches, and Applebee's, and a society that tells you you're supposed to subdue and dominate everything around you. The reality is that the further white Americans move away from their cultures of origin, English, Scottish, Italian, Irish, the more they long for a sense of true culture beyond what American consumerism can provide. Since black Americans were forcibly removed from our African cultures of origin centuries ago and were also cut off from mainstream culture in the US, we had to develop a unique cultural expression that can only be described as black American culture. And the exploitation of that culture has been big business in the U.S. since the days of minstrelsy. Since the ascent of the alleged king, there have been thousands of contenders to his throne. We can only hope that the conditions of their coronations would require them to both understand the history of the music they're choosing to reference and to shine a light on the pioneers that made their ascent possible in the first place.
Oh, Lord. That was a lot.
There we go. There we go.
That was a lot.
man. First of all, just for context, when does the concept of appropriation really begin in our country?
You know, I think really with the advent of what would be thought of as the blossoming of popular culture, I would say, like the late 19th century. Really during with the rise of like minstrelsy, I think mid 19th century to late 19th century, I would say, with the rise of minstrelsy, that's really, I think, just, you know, as soon as popular music became a thing, it really started with the mimicry and the mockery of black people. You know, the taking on of those characteristics, because, you know, they were seen as something silly, over the top, laughable, but then also fascinating, charismatic, exciting, you know, all of the tropes, all of the stereotypes that can be associated with blackness, with black culture. It was very evident even at that time. That's where it all started, really. You know, that blackface minstrelsy was the most popular form of entertainment from probably 1850 to the turn of the century.
On the nose.
Or the 1920s at the start of vaudeville.
I remember you and I, we've done it a couple of times. I've taught a class, Music of the Movement, talking about Black American musical expression throughout that period on to now. And in our first research, discovering people like Daddy Rice, who was a Northern entertainer, actually from New York State, I believe, who began largely in the concert halls and touring exactly what you're speaking about, minstrel shows. And such a revelation and an eye opener that he wasn't from some Southern town, some Southern slaveholding community. He was a Northerner, toured through the Midwest and the South, but in the North was where he had his roots. So exactly what you said, the fascination with what was becoming Black or African-American culture, using that and using these extended and overextended properties for material gain, for entertainment, for cheap laughs, for lowest common denominator. You hit it on the head. I think it starts really there, which is telling to note that even in that time, so-called white people recognized that there was a black culture.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it was very, you know, it was something that was very distinct from whiteness. I don't know that we can refer to sort of a pan-white culture that even existed at that time. America's always been a mosaic. The United States has always been a mosaic of various immigrant cultures. African-American or black American culture was sort of the dominant culture within the world of entertainment at that time. And it was unambiguous at that time. And then, you know, there has always been, I think, a history of popular music borrowing from the syncopated rhythms within, you know, African culture, what became African-American culture. You know, as I said in the video, the blue notes and the dominant chord voicings and, you know, eventually the blues scale and all of this. It always sort of made its way into popular music. It always has. Popular music would not be what it is without heavily, heavily borrowing from the influences of, you know, first enslaved people and then eventually, you know, freed Black people in this country. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I don't think that it's an overstatement to say that Black American music, we're talking specifically about music. The video wasn't really specifically about music, but I think music is a really good sort of landing spot to have this discussion around, to sort of house this discussion around, because it's so, you know, obviously illustrates the progression of this whole issue of cultural appropriation. But I don't think it's an overstatement to say that Black American music is the very foundation of American popular music. I don't think that's an overstatement.
Mm-hmm. I know in the video, your first tentpole example was Elvis Presley.
Mm-hmm.
And you migrated.
He always gets folks worked up. Elvis Presley always gets folks worked up one way or the other. It's going to be one extreme or another. And I catch it from both sides.
Yeah.
With him.
You migrated, of course, to other examples that you showed. I can't remember the sequence, but I know that Al Jolson was in there. The Beastie Boys were in there. Vanilla Ice was in there. And yeah,
Led Zeppelin, the Rolling Stones. Yeah.
The Beatles and the Stones.
Mm-hmm.
Elvis is problematic. We know why. There's stereotype around Elvis even.
Mm-hmm.
But if we're honest about it, he represented something. Fast forwarding to the 1950s with the advent of television, you could see as well as hear.
Mm-hmm.
And there were these templates that he borrowed heavily from just before his arrival on the scene that you could not often see, but you could hear. But he's the manifestation of the total package.
Yeah, he is. It's interesting because I get so much flack for being a Black person who actually appreciates Elvis Presley. I actually like Elvis Presley.
And that's
the revelation of the day. As having done as many videos on him, I've done a 3-part series on Elvis, where I really fleshed out kind of what the truth is about his, you know, the legend and the myth of Elvis, and how Black people grapple with this. Got flack from all sides on this, but I really do fundamentally have respect for what he actually did. But even within the context of appropriating Black culture, which he did.
When I listen to specifically Little Richard, B.B. King, not Chuck Berry, someone who escapes my mind right now, in that golden era, Bo Diddley, I think, all of them in some way or another actually praised Elvis for his singular talent.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Ray Charles, we know, did not.
There were some others who did
Chuck
not.
Chuck Berry did not.
Quincy Jones did not.
I do not. But I have the sense and the research to know Elvis is problematic largely because of his manager, Colonel Parker. Now, that dude was a dirtbag. But Elvis is complicit because he is the public face of a creation.
Yeah.
And if you can actually unpack that, talk about why this creation at that time is so polarizing.
Yeah, I think, you know, I really don't make any attempts to exonerate Elvis Presley, but I have, you know, like I said, I've done multiple videos kind of fleshing out this whole, you know, the legend of, you know, there was certain verbiage I used in that first series of videos, which if I could go back and do it again, I would speak a little bit differently about it, I think, which is probably one reason why I wanted to revisit the subject of Elvis Presley. But I mean, you had Black folks in the comments just going absolutely ballistic because, I mean, it's so ingrained in our culture, I think, and in our consciousness to revile this man.
Mm-hmm.
And it's part myth and it's part, you know, the truth of what it was. But I think there's just a lot that's been passed down around, you know, the idea, the mythology of Elvis Presley. That, you know, as with any massive figure, you got a lot of you got some truth out there and you got just a lot of, you know, just legend and mythological silliness that is not, you know, it's not really well founded. And so these this whole discussion about whether he was racist and he said, oh, the only thing black people can do for me is shine my shoes and buy my music. Not true. You know, it's nothing that he ever said. So clarifying, you know, just the truth of what he really was and what he actually did, that's important to me because, you know, I'm still grappling with my experience of the man. You know, it makes it, his fans make it really difficult, I will say.
Agreed.
To plug into him.
Agreed.
Because he's just one of those people. He's if you dare to criticize the man, you know, you got people coming out the woodwork.
It's worse than the beehive.
If you dare to utter his name and, you know, don't be black and dare to criticize Elvis Presley, because, you know, it is that beehive kind of energy where it's like,
worse.
You know,
it's worse.
They really feel they have to protect their icon, you know, and anyone who would dare to disparage besmirch his name.
Yeah.
They've got to, you know, put on the whole protective gear and just come, you know, combat you in the comment section. And I've been dealing with a whole lot of that. And I know anytime his name comes up, be prepared.
Yeah.
You know, be prepared. Yeah. Yeah. But the movie's out right now and there's a lot of discussion of him. So I felt like he would be a good launching point to have this conversation about. And, you know, in addition to me taking a little bit of a corrective action from the videos that I put out on him previously to kind of, you know, very declaratively state, he appropriated black culture. Of course he did. No, we're not, that's not in question at all.
He may have had appreciation, but it got to a level that was so out of control and so one-sided in its financial and social payoff for those that he borrowed from.
You can't say borrow because they're going to tear you up. They're going to tear you up for that one.
Whether you say he stole, took, whether you say he you know, ganked, if I can use 90s slang.
Hey, we're musicians. We're musicians. And so I guess there's a reality for both of us that we would, you know, slip up and use the term borrowed.
Of course.
Because there's a realism, I guess, that we both approach, you know, the question of influence.
Yeah.
Period.
Yeah.
Just musical influence.
Exactly.
We all know there's no original. From the greatest hero that you could possibly have, John Coltrane, Miles, they were all influenced. They all borrowed something from somebody.
Exactly.
And so in the sense of being a musician and
if
being influenced,
Handy could have a royalty every time a 12 bar blues was played, he would have died beyond rich. His great, great grandchildren would be extremely wealthy. If Charlie Parker could have gotten a royalty from every lick and phrase that people have copied, just like what you're saying, he would have died filthy rich.
And obviously what adds kind of a, you know, the sting to the Elvis conversation are the racial dynamics that are at play.
Yeah.
So we're not only speaking of musicians or singers being influenced by one another stylistically, we're talking about a so-called dominant culture, meaning just, you know, the numbers themselves, a dominant culture, then taking a quote unquote borrowing or stealing, if you prefer, from a minority culture.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then you got a whole power dynamic that's at play that sort of changes. It really does change the conversation. And I had a lot of people come through in the comments. It's very sort of dismissively saying, well, it's not a big deal. Everybody's influenced by everybody. Oh, he was just a kid. He grew up around black people. He was just playing what he knew. He was just singing the songs he knew. It's like, you know what? Elvis Presley, for all intents and purposes, you can say, yes, he had some Romani ancestry or whatever. Elvis was a white kid. Mm-hmm. Let's not deceive ourselves here. Yes, there may have been some traces of ancestry of whatever, but he grew up as a white kid.
In Mississippi.
Fully, firmly planted within, you know, Southern white culture. Mm-hmm. And he grew up with hillbilly music and he grew up with Southern gospel, but he also grew up around in proximity to
black blues,
black music, just like pretty much every other poor kid in the South did. Mm-hmm. Black and white people intermingled and mixed, and they always had and still do in the South.
Yeah.
So Elvis was not like, he wasn't unlike any other kid that would have existed at that time. He was not exceptional in that way.
Yeah.
He obviously knew that there was a culture that represented what his folks were doing. And there was a culture that represented what, you know, the other folks were doing that was somewhat forbidden.
Which is a strong commentary that you just mentioned, even beyond segregation legally. there's this cross-pollination of culture. Mm-hmm. When he did what he did, people saw it and knew what it was.
They absolutely You're dancing did.
Like,
and he knew. More importantly, you know, he knew.
He did.
He knew.
You're this dancing whole, like this guy. Yes, this guy.
This whole idea yeah. that Elvis, that this just sort of, that this music just sort of innocuously infiltrated his style and his presentation. I will say that because I am an Elvis fan from way back in the day, from when I was a teenager, I was really into Elvis as a teenager. And I had a cassette tape. This is, you know, back in my day, prehistoric times. But I had a little cassette tape when I was a teenager that I would play of very, very early Elvis recordings. And this is, we're talking about 1954, 55, which is some of the stuff that I really bonded with early on in my teenage years. And this was these were his appearances on a show called the Louisiana Hayride, which was something like the Grand Ole Opry. And Elvis was not doing so-called black music or race music, which is what they called it at the time. He was doing Western swing music. He was doing country and Western music. He was not doing the kind of music that he became successful for later on. So no, it was not just a given that Elvis Presley only really knew how to express just this one thing. If you listen to songs like That's All Right, Mama, this stuff is, you know, there's some blues in it. But Elvis Presley sounds like a country kid.
Yeah.
He sounds like he's singing straight up country music. And that was really where he was headed to. He was headed towards being probably, you know, kind of just a hipper, kind of edgier, young country singer.
Sure. Sure.
Until Colonel Tom Parker decided and Sam Phillips decided that they needed someone who was going to embody black music who was not black.
And the key turns, and it's funny you say Sam Phillips, not funny, but remarkable, because that's the same gentleman who 4 years earlier had recorded Howlin' Wolf before he left for Memphis to Chicago. So Sam Phillips was well versed on Sun Records with what the true black sound was. Very interesting that he was involved because he knew so-called race records.
Oh, yeah.
He recorded them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And their intention was, hey, we need a white kid who's going to sing this music. If I could find a white kid to do this, I'd have my payday. Mm. That was the absolute intention. It was an intentional marketing strategy. It was not something Elvis just sort of fell into or something that he didn't really understand what he was doing. You know, obviously he had been influenced by the blues because you could hear that on those early recordings. But the idea that he was going to become this white kid that sang, you know, his version of the blues was a super intentional PR move on their part. And they knew what they were doing. Sure. And it worked.
Sure it did.
And it worked.
Sure it did.
But, you know, the remarkable thing about the whole idea and the concept, and of course, the term cultural appropriation probably didn't pop up until I'm thinking like the early 70s, I want to say. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the term didn't exist. And the whole idea of that barely even existed at that time. And there, of course, were, you know, many recordings that featured syncopated rhythms and stuff, you know, Benny Goodman and Bing Crosby and all kinds of Al Jolson and white people that were borrowing from different, pulling from different elements of black culture. So that wasn't a new thing.
Right.
But what Elvis Presley was doing, sort of turning this thing on its head and saying, we're just going to do the music, you know, full on, just pull this blues music in, and we're not even going to dilute it. We're not going to house it and encase it in any kind of fancy, you know, artifice or whatever. We're not going to try to make it particularly palatable. We're just going to give this white kid, you know, a guitar and have him do this black music.
Right.
And, you know, the remarkable thing about it at the time is that it was understood to be what it was. It was black music.
Sure.
You know, unlike today where we have these ridiculous debates about what it actually is. Is Justin Timberlake really doing black music?
Yeah.
Robin Thicke or whomever, or Justin Bieber or even Eminem. It's like we have to have these conversations about what the music actually is now.
Right.
And they weren't having that conversation then because everybody knew what it was.
They did. They did.
It was unquestioned.
So much so that when a few years later, and this is not a music history lesson, but just facts, when the Rolling Stones come on the scene in the early 60s and the Beatles as well, a lot of the original OG blues musicians from America praise them until their dying day for the most part. Because why? The Rolling Stones said, hey, we're going to do this show, but we want Howlin' Wolf to open for us. We want to take Muddy Waters on tour.
Absolutely.
We want to bring over a blues review of the real stuff that our heroes are manifest before your very eyes so that you understand why we're geeking out about these guys so
much. Right, right.
And I feel like there's a real shift in what Elvis did versus what happens in the 60s with the Stones and the Beatles, in that there is this appropriation. There is this hand over fist money making exploitation, but there is this appreciation that supersedes and also creates an economic lane for these OG blues guys that never maybe would have had that type of not just exposure, but payday.
Right. Yeah. And I think, you know, it's important to note that they were able to learn from Elvis's mistakes in that area, or Colonel Tom Parker's mistakes and Elvis's mistakes in that area. You know, they had him as a reference. He was one of their, Elvis was one of their heroes, one of their idols, meaning the Stones and the Beatles and other groups. And, you know, they saw what he did and what he did not do.
Yeah.
It's also important to note that Elvis, you know, after that interview with Judd, I think he did Jet Magazine in maybe 58, where he had already, it might have been 1957, where this rumor had started that he said all Black people can do is to shine my shoes and buy my music. And he addressed this rumor. He said, I never said that. You know, that's, you know, and anyone who knows me knows that that is out of character for me. No one could ever trace the quote. It was literally something that had come from some obscure magazine that someone planted.
Sure.
They planted this rumor. But I think by that point, because, you know, having said they already were acknowledging what he was doing. He was appropriating culture. He was taking from Black music. Not Black people were not the only ones who hated Elvis. White people hated Elvis too. Mm. It's important to note that. Mm-hmm. White people did not like this kid. You know, teenagers loved him. DJs loved him.
Yeah.
But the parents and in communities, and they really disliked what he was doing.
He was wholesome, and he threatened to integrate their household with what you said earlier, race music.
Race music. Black and it was, yeah, culture. it was seen as obscene, and you know, all this hip swiveling and stuff.
Yeah.
He was just seen as such a, you know, a blight on the culture.
Yeah.
So think about, you know, everything that would have been going on with this. And he's a kid by this point, still 1957 or so, just out there, you know, being led and doing what he was told. Yeah.
Basically.
And so he was advised, I'm sure, to stop talking to the press. Elvis Presley didn't really do any interviews after that. 57, 58, he went to the army, whatever. He was done.
Yeah.
And then did a bunch of hip swiveling movies in the 1960s. So Elvis never really had any kind of a relationship with the press. You've never seen Elvis like going up and accepting awards and doing speeches at the Oscars and sitting down with talk show hosts and then being interviewed. And you don't have these visuals because they didn't happen.
Wow.
So we have to remember, you know, that as with any sort of legendary figures like Michael Jackson or whomever, and even more so back then, they didn't have this direct contact with the public or the press that entertainers do now. So there were very few opportunities for him to combat a lot of the misconceptions about him, or, you know, even develop a sort of relationship or trust.
Right.
With his public. It was just like, let them do with your legend whatever they choose to do.
Right.
You know, and so did when people talk about him not acknowledging, and I'll fully agree, he did not lift up Black creators enough. No, he did not. Mm-hmm. He didn't point the way enough.
Mm-hmm.
But he was, ultimately, he was just silent.
Yeah. Yeah.
He didn't do anything other than just live his life. Mm-hmm. Elvis Presley was silent.
Yeah, he was.
So I think, you know, I said all that to say that the Beatles and the Stones were able to learn from his example of just, you know, it sounds very silly to say about someone who was as successful as he was, but there was a certain powerlessness to the dynamic of his relationship with Colonel Tom Parker. Is he really didn't make any of the business decisions. You know, yes, there was a course correction that happened when the Beatles and the Stones came onto the scene and realized, like, hey, this is not all right. Like, clearly, everybody knows what we're pulling from.
Right.
Let's talk about it. Let's have these guys up on the stage and let's introduce people to them. And mm-hmm. let's make sure they are profiting, you know, at right. least somewhat from the popularity of this music. Because for the Stones, this was not even, there was no way that they could even claim this as their culture.
Right.
It was so distant.
They had to point back
being
to
European.
Exactly. It was it was a Black American
yes.
invention.
And for them, it was, yeah, so easy to acknowledge that.
Yeah. Yeah. They didn't grow up in the cloak of this country's, you know, foolishness. Britain had its own issues. But where I really want to get you to address, we mentioned the Stones, the Beatles. Taking it forward into my era, which is really your era too, I'll mention the Beastie Boys as people who, again, come from an alternative culture to African-American life, but they adopt these styles, but they bring with them the creators of these styles. It's hard for me to say the Beastie Boys are in the same category as they're not.
Mm-hmm.
They're not. Whether you like them or hate them is up to you. But I can say with my own eyes, over and over, seeing them value, affirm, and point the way back toward folks like Biz Markie and Run DMC and Nas, and folks who they were just as excited about to turn their largely white audiences onto, because those were the originators and innovators of a cultural phenom that the Beasties profited from.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a completely different category, similar to the Stones. So now, is the goal to eliminate appropriation, or what is the goal? Because we find ourselves at a crossroads here. People coming into their own consciousness, regardless of their ethnicity. It is wrong to exploit something that is not mine, especially if that person finds themselves in the dominant culture. Mm-hmm. It is wrong. We have seen timeless examples of this person ethically has no weight. Has no truck, has no compass. So where do we go in 2022 with regard to cultural appropriation?
So I think, you know, it's important to acknowledge that I had a kind of a back and forth with someone in my Instagram comments, mm-hmm. and he kind of made this point that you're illustrating specifically about the Beastie Boys. Because, uh-huh. I mean, you start touching on some of the favorites,
sure.
you know, particularly for our generation and forward. Mm-hmm. It's like, hey, don't touch so-and-so, you
yeah.
know, and there was a lot of that in the comments, you know, even beyond Elvis.
Yeah.
So it's like, hey, this person, you know, this group was legit, or this person was legit. And, you know, they did speak about, you know, who their influences were or whatever. There should be all these exceptions mm-hmm. to the idea of cultural appropriation, who does and who does not appropriate. And the question that I asked going into the video was, and I had a lot of challenges with like what to name the video.
I mm-hmm.
And I finally came to the conclusion of really centering it around this central question. Gearing it around the central question, which was, when does appreciation become appropriation?
Uh-huh.
And I think it's important to understand that the very definition of appropriation is when a majority culture, and let's not forget that we're speaking about, again, these power dynamics,
yeah.
when a majority culture profits or benefits from a minority culture, you are taking elements of a minority culture and you're taking that on, the affects, the stylings, the mannerisms, the whatever it is, their culture somehow, and you are finding a way to profit or benefit from that either financially or socially.
Yes.
So when you boil it down to its most, you know, basic elements, yes, the Beastie Boys would be considered as cultural appropriation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, mm-hmm. that's not the end of the story. You know, they don't just all get sort of lumped into one pile there.
Right.
You know, we have to then begin to ask ourselves about the integrity of their artistry.
Right.
You know, then you start getting right. into questions of
integrity
artistic
of their
integrity.
Finances too.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. There
mm-hmm.
are a whole lot of knobs that you're turning now within this conversation mm-hmm. about who has appropriated and who hasn't, and what harm it's done or what benefit it has given to that minority culture. There are a whole lot of questions to yeah. ask beyond, is it cultural appropriation?
That's right.
Because if you are an artist, a white artist in the United States who is making money off of Black art, technically, that is cultural appropriation in the most basic sense. Yes, it is.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you.
Is all a cultural appropriation made equal? No, it is not.
No,
it is not, because we don't lump in, you know, Eminem and the Beastie Boys and the Stones. We don't lump them in with Vanilla Ice, who's True. Always the poster boy for like the worst cultural appropriators. Yeah. But we don't lump them all into one big group, one big pile. We don't do that,
right.
You know. So it's very possible to show that appreciation, to have artistic integrity, and to shine a light on those Black artists, in spite of appropriating certain elements of Black culture. It is very possible to do that, and I think the Beastie Boys would be a really good example of that. Who are some other good examples that you know of?
Oh man, so many. To be honest with you, any majority artist that plays popular music is appropriating. Why? Because at the core of American popular music is
Black
music.
Period. It's almost impossible.
I mean,
you can be influenced by Black music, but then to say you have taken this on as the central kind of thrust to your artistic expression.
Any popular music, I don't care whether it's country, if it's pop, if it's hip hop, if it's blues, if it's rock, it comes from Black American culture. And as we've said time and time again, the way you approach it in reverence, which is probably where you were going,
mm-hmm.
will determine whether or not you're accepted by the minority
right.
culture, or
right.
you're rejected appropriately by the minority culture. You have to come with a level of sincerity, of study, of humility, and of excellence. And if you can bridge all four of those in our book, you can be okay. But that's really what it's about. It's literally, yeah, anything that you touch in this country musically, coming from a popular perspective with any kind of it's Black American
yeah,
influence.
It is. It's going to be
the lightest little tinsy drop
right.
to the biggest pantomime.
Yeah. Yeah. And it spans, you know, it exists across the spectrum. It really does. I mean, from country and Western artists who you would not really think of as being influenced by Black music. But if you really have studied the history of the development of country and Western music, then you know the influence of Black music is there. And then, you know, the other end of that spectrum, slathering cork paint all over your face and making
wow.
absolutely no attempt to obscure, you know, this overtly mocking reference to your version of Black culture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there is a vast, mm-hmm. a very broad spectrum
yeah,
of ways that you can
use of AAVE or whatever.
Right.
Yeah.
Of ways that you can reference the influence of Black culture on what you are doing.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, it's important to kind of, I guess, bifurcate a little bit with those conversations about cultural appropriation versus artistic integrity. We have to be able to, as I said, turn each of those knobs kind of individually and calibrate that conversation from artist to artist, because no, they don't belong in a bin, you know, with absolutely no distinction
yeah.
between them. No, they do not. The idea of cultural appropriation does not necessarily always have to have a negative connotation. You know, for that reason, if there is artistic and, you know, financial integrity,
mm-hmm.
no, it does not have to have a negative connotation necessarily. There may be a lot of Black folks who appreciate you appreciating their culture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to what degree has that happened in this country?
Mm-hmm.
How many examples are there of white artists who have really done their just due and have truly paid homage, you know, in an integral way?
Mm-hmm.
How many examples are there of that? I can name a handful. You know, I feel like, and I don't know the full story behind, you know, what he did, but I do know a lot about Paul Simon's career. But I think he would be mm-hmm. one
okay.
Who was borrowing not necessarily from Black American culture in the 80s
mm-hmm.
so much as he was African culture.
Yeah, West African,
but I think
yeah.
in my book,
mm-hmm.
that is at least a little bit of a framework
yeah.
For yeah. exactly how to do that in a way that is that carries the least amount of exploitation
yeah.
possible. He brought, you know,
Ladysmith Black Mbazo
to the United States.
Yeah.
He brought those guys on tour with him.
For the
and
album.
Those guys at, you know, and different, because they were ubiquitous when we were kids.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, it was almost at certain points, like, where is Paul Simon? You know, he centered them so much in his work. Mm-hmm. And he paid them to do what they did. And if there's anyone who knows about the business that was going on behind the scenes, the financial business that was going on behind the scenes, please forgive me if I'm being remiss, and if he didn't pay the guys and whatever, y'all let me know.
Mm-hmm.
But at least from the point of view that we saw, you know, that the public facing part of what he was doing, you know, at least
it appeared
as though he wanted to operate with a certain amount of integrity.
Yeah, I don't know Eminem's numbers financially, but I do know that he has given credit numerous times to Tretch from Naughty by Nature for directly influencing his wordplay, which I would argue is Eminem's greatest asset. Black creators have said the same. Eminem's wordplay is, you know, top notch. People who I respect, like Redman and, you know, beyond, have given Eminem their top five and top 10. And the fact that he was so excited to work with Dr. Dre when he first burst on the scene. Hey, man, I'm getting to work with the best, period.
Hmm.
I've got to raise my game to his game because he's the best. That, to me, dictated a reverence that I had not seen with some fellow creators. Even beyond that, Third Bass in the late 80s, those of you who really follow hip hop, those were the guys at the Latin Quarter in New York City, you know, risking life and limb to be down. Not because they were trying to front, but because they were about the culture, period.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they were about. MC Search and Pete Nice and Daddy Rich, I think, was their DJ at the time. But anyway, specifically MC Search, he had a window into the culture, you know, like no other before then, even beyond the Beastie Boys. Like, that was a stark reminder of, hey, this guy is doing it the right way. He discovered Nas. And when he discovered Nas, he's like, look, man, I will help you negotiate your deal. And I don't want any money. I'm doing this because the culture needs you. So there's another one example of that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we can go back to, I don't know why my examples tend to be 40 and 50 years back.
That's
but,
okay.
You know, as many objectionable things as I may have to say about Eric Clapton, I think he was another one that at least attempted to shine a light on a lot of his heroes. And there have been many more. I do want to go out of my way to say that regardless of where a person's level of artistic integrity falls with any of these people that could be accused of cultural appropriation, from Iggy Azalea to Vanilla Ice to whomever, you're always going to see Black people in the music videos. you're always going to see Black folks somewhere tap dancing, smiling, and appearing to co-sign what is going on. So that in and of itself is not enough to make a judgment of an endorsement by the Black community to make a judgment about whether or not this person is integral in what they're doing.
Yeah.
So don't ever go by that, because you can pay somebody enough and they'll do and say whatever.
Sure.
Just because you got Black folks who are on stage with the person, that's no indicator that they have a pass.
Right.
At all.
Right.
So I want to go out of my way to say that. But I think you have to kind of look at the confluence of opinions from people who value artistic integrity and who understand those genres, and get a gauge. People within the Black community get a gauge of how that artist comes across to them. That everybody's going to have, you know, different opinions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Black people are not a monolith. We're not going to all agree about any one thing.
Right.
But if the general feeling amongst most Black fans of hip hop is that Eminem is legit and they don't really have a problem with the guy, I think that's a good place to start.
Sure.
That's at least a good, you know, ground zero to begin from. Like, hey, maybe this is all right. So I would say be guided by members of that particular cultural group. Like, how do they feel about him?
Yeah.
You know, in general, how what is the general feeling about this person?
Mm-hmm.
Do a lot of Black folks seem to have a problem with person X?
Mm-hmm.
If they do, take some time to step back and maybe think about why. think about why that is. And it could be anything. It could be musical integrity. Mm-hmm. It could be the business behind the scenes. It could be the fact that there's some straight up mimicry going on, you know, where they have taken another person's style and just made it their own, could have taken music and just made it their own. You know, there could be a lot of things that are at play. And if you are a white person and you're like, man, I don't know how to judge, you know, who's legit and who's not amongst these white artists that have these heavy black influences, you may not be the best person to judge that in terms of the artistic integrity of what they're doing.
Here's what I'll say, and excuse me for interrupting you. Listen, if they ever cite their influences, that's a place to start. Because if they are selfless enough to cite their influences, that's a start to say, maybe this person has a level of integrity. Yeah. If they never cite their influences and never tell you who to listen to that influenced them, chances are that they aren't approaching the culture in the right way, in my opinion.
Yeah. And I, you know, I listen for things like, you know, did you suddenly develop a black scent out of nowhere? You know, that's it's popular nowadays. And folks like Iggy Azalea have led the way. I mean, Iggy Azalea took that stuff to a whole new level, to the point where it was like, you know, we're just going to try this on like a freaking costume. In my opinion, it's audio minstrelsy.
Yeah.
There really is no difference, you know, and at the very least with, you know, somebody like Elvis, you could say that he was who he was. You know, he didn't attempt to create a character that sounded black. You could still tell this was a white dude singing. You know, so when you have things like that exist, it's like, you know, we can all be bewitched by the music. We can be bewitched by the groove. You know, what's the song that Robin Thicke put out several years ago that he ended up being sued over?
Blurred Lines.
Appropriately titled Blurred Lines. You know, you can be bewitched by that. You know, I had a Facebook friend at the time. This is what, you know, 7-8 years ago that song came out. So it was all about Facebook. And, you know, oh, my God, I just love this beat. This is the most amazing thing. I'm thinking, has this woman ever heard Marvin Gaye? Chances are she ain't ever heard Marvin Gaye. Yeah. She does not know where this comes from.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, unless you really do have deep musical knowledge, you may not even realize when appropriation is happening.
That's very well
put. You know, step back and consider whether your musical knowledge or lack thereof might be obscuring your ability to even recognize cultural appropriation in music.
Absolutely. We're going to go to my favorite part of the show, which is when you let us know how we can find our voices more effectively, the Finding Your Voice column. But before we go to that, I've had a ball. Hopefully, folks, you have too. Dara, let them know where to find you again.
Dara Star Tucker on TikTok. That's two R's and star. Dara Tucker B on Instagram. And then you can find me at Dara Star Tucker or Dara Tucker on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube. I'm really trying to build up my YouTube, you guys. Go to my YouTube, which is youtube.com/Dara Star Tucker. And my Patreon, that's the place where, those are my folks now. We're up to, I think, about 30 patrons at this point. So I'm so excited. We're developing a little community over there.
Come on,
it's really exciting for me. Those folks are dear to my heart. So if you're a patron and you're listening, thank you from the bottom of my heart for putting, you know, your money where your mouth is. A lot of folks are, oh my God, you deserve to be on TV. You should blah, blah, blah. It's like, well, you know, what are we doing right now?
Exactly.
You know, I've got a handful of people who are lending their support every month and saying, we believe in what you're doing. So I just thank you to those of you who joined the Patreon. But yeah, the Finding Your Voice, I want to talk about, because we had some specific questions about what practical measures could be taken to address the issue of cultural appropriation. Like, hey, is this something we need to do something about? What can we do? And what does it mean to be responsible and to appreciate versus, you know, cold appropriation? What does that even mean? So I just want to talk about practical things that can be done to avoid being the worst of the cultural appropriators.
That's good.
Silencing the sound of the whole place, no words are spoken. Do we hear the cries of the broken, or do we cradled in a tomb of our making. No dreams of waking. Do we know the price we are paying? Or do we sleep?
So in today's Finding Your Voice segment, I want to talk about some practical steps if you are a creator and if you are wondering where the lines might be in terms of cultural appropriation. I don't want to be guilty of that and that kind of thing. What are some practical steps that you can take to avoid being the cautionary example of like an Iggy Azalea or a Vanilla Ice who are appropriating Black culture without any real regard for the integrity of that culture and the exploitative nature that can come with cultural appropriation? We're going to use Black creators as an example, but this, of course, applies to any minority culture that you might be considering pulling from to create your art. The first piece of advice I would give you is to uplift Black creators. Lift them up. Talk about them whenever possible. Anytime you have the opportunity to talk about who your influences are, to talk about who contemporary artists are that are doing work that you love, that have possibly influenced you, or that you're enjoying collaborating with, talk about them, collab with them, bring them into your process, give them opportunities to share the stage with you, to be a part of your art, to be a part of your work. Uplift Black creators and voices. And as I mentioned with the Paul Simon example, center them, put them out front, put them side by side with you in the work that you're doing. If you're a writer, invite them to be an illustrator or vice versa. If you're a singer, have them do more than just do backup for you. You know, put them out front and allow people to hear what they really do in the integrity of what it really is, rather than simply using them for the limited purpose that you need them for. James Taylor, one of my favorite singers, has a background singer who's Black, whose name is Arthur McCullough, and he will have a moment in every show, or he did have a moment in every show where he would highlight Arthur and just have him do this incredible rendering of Shower the People, which is one of James Taylor's biggest songs. But he would have this moment where Arthur had the spotlight directly on him, and we got to hear him as something other than just a backing vocalist. That's a really good example of centering Black voices, quite literally. The third thing you can do is to provide financial support, provide opportunities for Black creators to profit from the work that has influenced you. Whether you are contributing financially to them doing the work that they're doing, or if you are directing other people to their work and letting them know how to support that creator, provide opportunities for that Black creator to financially benefit from the work that they do. It's not enough just to say, oh, Howlin' Wolf was great. He was a great influence. The Rolling Stones brought him out on the road with them, and they gave him opportunities to perform, and they paid him. So providing substantive financial support is another great way to put some muscle behind your support of Black creators. And I mentioned talking about your influences, not only talking about those influences, but studying the music deeply. Make sure that you are a student of the music or whatever the art is that you do. Make sure that you know your history. If you have influences, find out who their influences are and study them. It's not enough to just present what you do in a bubble. Your music came from somewhere. Everything that we do comes from somewhere. If you have not grown up as a part of that particular culture, there may not have been natural opportunities for you to be exposed to the real framers of that art. So find out really what the true history is of the music, of the art that you love to do, and uplift those influences, uplift the influences of your influences, and be well studied. And finally, number five, find your own voice. If you are someone who literally just takes something that a Black creator did and you do it as a white person, that immediately is going to be a red flag to people who are tuned in to the idea of appropriation. You're not really attempting to find your own way of doing something. You simply want to do the white version of something that a Black person has already done. This is a pattern that has existed throughout history. And when this happens, you can pretty much be guaranteed you're going to be on the you know what list from most Black listeners, because we are accustomed to seeing this pattern over and over and over again. So if you want to be thought of as having artistic integrity and as someone who is not blatantly appropriating Black culture than avoid blatantly imitating Black performers and Black artists. Find your own voice and your own way to express that art. That's it for Finding Your Voice. Thank you so much for listening to the I Am All Over the Place podcast. We have really enjoyed this episode, which focused really more on the musical side of cultural appropriation. I'm sure you guys have a lot more comments and questions. Please go ahead and leave them for us. Leave us a review of the podcast. That really helps us to go up in the rankings. And thank you to everyone who has listened thus far. We're really encouraged by the amount of feedback that we get from the podcast. Remember, this is also on YouTube. If you want to watch the podcast, remember, you can find that on my YouTube channel. But thank you so much. We will see you in the next episode. Have a good one.